G'day, Dons fans. Our stress levels were pushed right to the brink on Saturday as we fought our way back against the Saints. A late Jake Stringer bomb from outside 50, putting us in front for the first time for the day, and a spirited last 5 or 6 minutes saw us hang on and win by 4 points. I'm Jonathan Walsh, and joining me in the Don the Stats studio to preview our round four gather round clash against the Power is Ian Hume. Humey, mate, how's things?
Oh, things are always good coming off a win, and I'm also on school holidays now, so there's a nice bit of relaxing with the family. And fortunately for me, I'm off to Gather Round tomorrow with my friend Trent, who's a Port Adelaide supporter. He was a Essendon supporter until Gavin Wanganeen went to Port, so he followed him. So it's going to be a fun time. We're going to 7 of the 9 games, and it's going to be my first time at Adelaide Oval. So really excited to see just how good a venue it is, and hopefully we get another win there for Gather Round. How about yourself?
I'd love to say I was on school holidays, mate, but work's nice and busy and plenty going on. The Easter break feels like a distant memory already. Very jealous that you're heading over, and I'm sure you'll represent the Essendon faithful loud and proud in the crowd. Mate, I'm going pretty well all in all, but yeah, could do with a holiday myself.
Yeah, well, hopefully it comes up sooner rather than later for you. Look, before we get on to tonight, you debuted a new, what we think will be a semi-regular show that will be exclusive to our Patreon. It's The Medical Room. You've been joined by physiotherapist and Don the Stat patron, Pat Luilia. Sorry, Pat, if I've butchered your last name there. To talk through just what the injuries on the Essendon injury list mean and what's involved in the recovery of those injuries. I listened to the first episode this afternoon and learned a heap. And so thanks both to you and Pat, who you both did a fantastic job on that. And I think people will get a lot out of listening to that, especially when you don't always get the most information out of the club regarding what injuries are and what they mean.
Yeah, credit to Pat, actually. It was his idea, and he approached us about it. And yeah, great idea. And really insightful. I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot from it. The whole idea is just to educate, not to diagnose. We obviously don't have the inside knowledge that the club is working through. So it's not sort of specifically about the individuals, but just trying to give a bit of background about what some of the terms might mean and get our head around it and understand what a typical rehab for certain types of injuries might look like and the like. Let's hope we don't keep him too busy and we don't have too much to report on the injury front, but when we do, it's great to be able to tap into Pat's experience and knowledge base to help let us learn and understand a little bit more about it.
Yeah. In an ideal world, we wouldn't need Pat to come on and have a show, but I think, you know, every month or every so often when we've got some injuries to talk about, just so people can get their head around it, I think it's a great idea. And yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how it evolves across the course of the year. And speaking of Patreon, as always, we do like to thank those who have signed up with us this week. So big thanks to William Carter, Robert Miletic, Chris Drago, Michael Dingo, Ross Ubergang, Lynn Huilia, Jeremy Walsh, Daniel Anderson, Josh Dwyer, Aaron Barnes, Drew Sten, Michael Day, Andrew Shedden, and Flynn. Thank you for your support this week in signing up. Hopefully you enjoyed the medical room episode that Jono put out and anything else that we've been putting out there. We really appreciate your support.
Yeah, another huge response, mate. Thanks to all the new subscribers and to everyone who continues to support us. We're really, really grateful that you're forking out some of your hard-earned and spending time and energy in engaging with what we do. We're really, really appreciative of it. So thanks very much. Mate, it's always good to review a win. So why don't we move straight into it and have a chat about the game against the Saints on Saturday?
Yeah, well, it didn't really look possible. We were reviewing a win following the first third of the game, but Essendon managed to claw their way back into it and took their lead for the first time with 6 minutes remaining and holding on until the siren, lodging their second win of the year. So the scores ended Essendon 10-11, 71 to defeat St Kilda 9-13, 67. Look, let's start with the bad and what happened in the first quarter. It looked bad watching from home, just how easy the Saints were moving the ball into their forward 50. I certainly let my real feelings known on Twitter. I haven't deleted them. I think you should leave up some of the things you said in the bad times so you can still appreciate the good. But you were at the game and we spoke about the importance of our ball movement last week. What was letting us down during the opening of the game? It did seem like we were making a lot of mistakes and really falling into the Saints' trap in how they wanted us to move the ball.
Yeah, you certainly went full nuff, didn't you? Yeah, I look, I know we had some help from the Saints missing some opportunities, but I sort of yeah, kept the faith. I at no point did I feel like we were completely out of the game, and again, that was probably thankful to the Saints for not putting it with out of our reach and missing some opportunities they had to convert scoring opportunities into goals. But yeah, even when the Saints got out to 19 points midway through the first quarter, I still felt that we were only really a goal away from settling into the game, and we were able to do that. We got the margin pretty close there by quarter time. They kicked the first two goals of the second quarter and got the margin out to 22 points. But I just felt we were just a little bit of a tidy up away from getting ourselves back in the game, getting on even terms, and there was so long still left to play that. Yeah, arguably the game still could have gone either way. They could have blown it right open. But, 4 goals isn't a lot in modern footy. And yeah, I didn't feel like we were, ready to pack up and fly the white flag, maybe unlike some Essendon teams of the past might have done. So yeah, I kept the faith and remained reasonably confident we were going to continue to claw our way back into the game. I think just in that early part of the game, we just seemed in a real hurry in the first quarter in particular, and in that early bit of the second quarter as well. We just lacked the composure and controlled ball movement that we spoke about in our preview that we felt was really the order of the day. Instead, we tried to go fast and we made some mistakes. We weren't as clean as we could have and should have been. A little bit like the early parts of that game against the Swans, it wasn't really down to pressure. Whilst we do know that the Saints are a high pressure team, it was more just about a lack of composure from our behalf that caused some of those errors. The Saints won the ball back inside their 4:50 five times for the match. The AFL average is 3.6 a game in 2024, so they outperformed the AFL average by a decent percentage there, and two of those were in the first quarter. So, when the AFL average is about one a quarter, for us to do it twice in the first quarter was indicative of just the way we coughed the ball up and the mistakes we made. In the second quarter, we were turning the ball over in the Saints' attacking half of the middle of the ground. So we were getting it out of our defensive 50, but not advancing much further than that. The AFL average is 17.6 sort of turnovers, or on average, you win the ball back 17.6 times a game in that part of the ground. And the Saints only had 17 for the match. So they were, they're sort of AFL average in that regard, but they had 8 in that second quarter. So, we just gave them the ball back way too many times in their forward half of the ground across the first half of the game. You do know what you're going to get in terms of that pressure of St Kilda. I did touch on that, but yeah, we just made it hard for ourselves. And the Saints clearly went into a game with a plan on how to expose Nick Martin and Jake Kelly, and that really paid off. So it wasn't just that we made mistakes and coughed the ball up. When we did do that, the Saints were really well positioned to take advantage of it.
Yeah, it almost seemed to mirror the match that we played against the Saints the previous season, where a combination of Saints pressure and our mistakes let them jump out to an early lead. Although, as you say, unlike that game from last year, they didn't convert as well as they did that game, and so it sort of kept us in a little bit there. But we did seem to turn it around a lot quicker than we did last time. You sort of mentioned sort of partway through the second quarter, we really got the match back on our terms, and that was a lot earlier than it was the previous year. What were the things that we adjusted so that we did achieve that and got the match back where we could start to really drive how the game was being played?
Yeah, there were sort of three things that came to mind or I spotted during the game. We moved Dyson Heppel to a wing sort of in that second quarter and used him as the defensive cover role for Nick Martin as opposed to Jake Kelly. And we were able to do it. Dyson's obviously not fleet of foot, and St Kilda made the decision to start Brad Hill forward and try to expose Nick Martin by having him be responsible for a really dangerous player. And I think that probably did play on Nick's mind a little bit at times in that first quarter. He made some uncharacteristic mistakes. Dyson's a player that reads the ball really well. He's great in the air, so it really suited his attributes. And because Brad Hill wasn't on a wing, they didn't have that speed there to expose him. He didn't have to worry about playing on a real quick and explosive winger. And it just meant that Jake Kelly could tighten up and just play a bit more of a regular wing role. And that just reduced their opportunity to overlap and use Dyson in a role that was really effective and suited his, as I said, his attributes. I think the other thing too is unlike last year, the contest is now a big feature of our game. You know, if the Essendon edge is anything, it's about really being hard and physical at the contest and winning, you know, more than our share of contested ball. And we really upped our performance in that part, and that allowed us to get territory and then press our front half of the ground. And then we got that forward half press to really work. Last year, we were really reliant, particularly in the first half of the season, in having to move the ball from defensive 50 to forward 50 to score. And in that game against St Kilda last year at the G, we had to take risks. So we had to work overtime to get up the ground and then get back down when we weren't scoring. And that was really taxing. And St Kilda, you know, were fitter and stronger and outran us. And we basically spent all of our petrol tickets just getting back into the game. And by the time we did that, St Kilda had, you know, then, you know, ran back over the top of us. So with 2.5 quarters still to play, we were able to just chip away at their lead in a method that was a bit more sustainable than what we did last year.
Yeah, and you touched on it before, but a lot of what got us back into the game was our ability to win clearance. And even without Setterfield against St Kilda, who's been a big part of why we've been so effective in this space this year, we really managed to work them over. We won total clearances 23 to 10 and centre clearances 9 to 11, not sorry, 9 to 1 in the second half. You know, and that's again, that's even with Durham, you know, who played, he probably was at the majority of centre bounces until he went off. Going out of that midfield with his concussion. The skipper was obviously the standout there. He had 6 centre clearances and he attended every centre bounce, and no other player on the ground, either a St Kilda or an Essendon player, had more than 2 centre clearances. So he was far and away the most dominant centre clearance midfielder in on the day, and he obviously has a lot of other attributes that are really important to our team. But I also felt we did really well to nullify Marshall. So across the first two games, he'd had 16 clearances all up, so an average of 8 a game, but he only had 2 this game. And this is where I think the dual ruck setup can have a big impact. It means you can wear down those solo rucks across the course of a game. That's obviously a small sample size, but our clearance game is becoming a big weapon for us. It's allowing us to both take territory, so win the ball, move the ball forward, and allows us to get the game on our terms as much as possible.
Yeah, we didn't have the scoreboard impact this week from stoppages that we've had in the first 2 weeks, albeit it was a much lower scoring game than we had in the first 2 weeks anyway. So sort of take it a little bit with a grain of salt, but we scored 8 points from centre bounces and 22 points from stoppages for the game. St Kilda scored 2 points and 19 points. So, you know, that gave us the advantage that ultimately allowed us to win the game by what was the margin in the end, 4 points or so. So, yeah, so it was arguably the difference. But we did average 16 points from centre bounces and 35.5 points from stoppages over the first 2 weeks. So it was down on that, albeit we won the contest and won the battle. And it gave us territory, and that allowed us to set up the game, you know, in the way that we wanted to. We scored 2 goals, 2 from turnovers in the forward, you know, forward half of the midfield. So, you know, that was a strong indication that territory game, which we built upon clearance, really did work for us. And yeah, ultimately was the difference between us winning and losing.
Yeah, and I think part of that lower scores from stoppage is partly down to the fact that the Saints are a well-drilled and well-set up side in terms of those defensive structures. And when teams have those stoppage plays, like it's a centre bounce or a stoppage, that they're much more likely to be set up and have better defensive structures to, you know, defend those issues. But I think, as you said, it allows us to take territory, and then because we had that territory, it allows us to play the defensive zone that we wanted to, which is that high press. I think people would have really noticed when they watched, whether at the ground or on TV, just how often we were able to turn the ball back over in the middle of the ground, and having players who are nominally defenders getting really high up the ground. So obviously McGrath's goal, you know, he's playing as sort of half back pocket, but he's right up at the 50 and able to get that rebound and have a chance at goal. And Nick Martin obviously ran through the ground and nearly brought the house down with his attempt at goal playing off the half back. So the way in which we're playing is trying to pressure those defenders from the other team in terms of them exiting the back 50. We saw the you know, we saw the influence that had. So Bonner from St Kilda, you know, he had 30 possessions, but he had 17 turnovers. So then part of that was just down to our pressure and our press and the way we were able to stop them from exiting 50 the way they would have liked. And, you know, it wasn't something that was working early on. And then that partly came down to the fact that clearances were split early in the game. And so it was more of an even territory game. But once we got that deep forward entries, and even if the Saints were winning it there, we were able to set up, get the ball back and allow us to get repeat entries. And it felt really like there were multiple times that the Saints were forced wide, exiting from our forward line, only for a Mackay or a Heppel to take the mark and send it back for another taking thrust. So they took 7 and 5 intercept marks respectively, and that was the most on the ground from any players. And our ground defence just in general was much better. So in the mid zone, so the period between, or the section of the ground between the two arcs, we took 12 intercept marks, and that was compared to 5 total across the first two games. And I think that's, if you wanting to see if our ground defense is working, if you're watching the game and wanting something from the eye test, seeing our players take those mid-zone intercept marks, I think is a really good sign that we're denying the opposition easy ball movement and also being able to set up well defensively to win it back. So if you're listening to this and you want to, you know, sort of watch for things that suggest that our ground defense is working, watch for us taking those mid-zone intercept marks. Now, one thing about our setup you spoke about on Twitter in particular was about how we use Nick Cox to force the Saints to take wide options. Does this follow on from the type of defense it seemed that the club was looking to execute at the back end of 2023, when particularly you were talking about how we'd changed our approach from the start of the season to the latter part of the season?
Yeah, I'll touch on Nick Cox in a second, but I think fans and members of the AFL media have found it hard to, well, I think members of the AFL media probably haven't found it hard. They just go with what's going to generate content and engagement, which is fair enough. That's their job. But I think largely people have found it hard to differentiate between the intent and the outcome. You know, what do we want to have happen versus what actually is happening? And, you know, we've been talking about this since the second half of 2023, and that we shifted from a team that defended from the back half of the ground to the front half of the ground, and things were likely to get worse before they got better. And, you know, that even after the Swans game, we saw those really messy and ugly looking stats about conceding, you know, coast to coast transitions and the like, and how we were ranked, you know, 16th or whatever it was in the AFL, and how poor it was. And, you know, that's the reality. That's what was happening. But it certainly wasn't the intent, and there were some holes in what we were doing, but it wasn't, for me, it never felt game plan orientated. It was just a real gap in execution that we needed to tidy up. The Saints shifted the ball from defensive 50 to forward 50, so coast to coast, 9 times on Saturday across the course of the game. The AFL average is 9.7 per game. So, you know, that was a huge improvement from the 13 and 15 times that it happened in the first two games against a team that, you know, has some good users. You know, Bonner's been in good form. Wanganeen Miller has been in really good form. We spoke about that in our preview. Yeah, it was a good acid test, and we came up trumps, and it was the best that it's been, you know, arguably in the last couple of years under Brad Scott. I think the other thing that we've spoken about previously quite a lot is the importance of clearance and contested ball to getting territory in the first place, and also to achieving deeper forward 50 entries as a starting point to defending the ground. It's a lot easier to defend the ground when you're starting your defense, you know, as close to your goal as you possibly can. And it's really hard to play a forward half game if you're not getting the ball there frequently enough in the first place. And those things happened for us on the weekend. For much of the last 2.5 quarters, we got a really good sample size of what it's meant to look like, and the outcome meant the attention. It's aggressive. You know, if teams do get over the back of us, we can be exposed. And that's where the roles, you know, you don't see a lot of it on the stat sheet, but the roles of Gresham and Menzies and Hobbs when he was resting, or well, not resting, but playing as a forward, Caldwell when he was playing as a forward, and even Harry Jones were really important in not letting the ball out easy too often. It was a much better level of execution than we've seen previously. And if you want a little snippet of what it looked like, if you on the AFL app, you can go and look at the team stats by the heat maps under the team stats by quarter. And if you just look at the the heat map and how concentrated it is in our forward 50 in that last quarter, it gives you a really strong idea of how we were able to lock the ball in. On the Nick Cox one, this wasn't so much about setup or structure, because the structure was already there. It was just a really smart adjustment that looked to me to be player driven in the last quarter. So if you remember the first St Kilda kick in the last quarter, so Langford kicked it behind from a set shot pretty early in quarter four. The Saints went straight down the corridor. Stocker took a mark on Gresham's back, a really good mark. But Stocker, it was always going to be in a position to outmark a player like Gresham, and then Hill ran past the handball. They took it out pretty easily, and we were fortunate that Harry McKay, sorry, Ben McKay, Mackay, I've stuffed that up twice there with his first name and his last name, but Ben Mackay ended up taking a really strong intercept mark at halfback. So we got away with it, but the Saints did really expose us there. At the next kick-in, Nick Cox went and filled that spot in the zone, and kicking to a one-on-one to a tall player like Cox against a player like Stocker, who is not a key position size, is a much different proposition. And what it does do for the St Kilda is it then exposed them to the risk of Cox potentially intercepting mark close to our goal when and exposing themselves on the turnover. So instead, what they did, having that option blocked up, was they went down the line to the numbers, and I think one of them, Draper, just spoiled the ball straight out of bounds. I think we got a stoppage from another one as well. So yeah, it was just really pleasing to see some adjustment in game. What looked to be player driven, it may not have been, but I don't recall seeing the runner get out there, and using the attributes that we had to really slow St Kilda down and change the way that they were trying to move the ball.
Well, firstly, I don't think you need to apologize to Mackay, as we know that Ben and Harry are actually the same person, so you can call them either name and you're going to get it right there. Secondly, you've touched on Cox there, and it's really pleasing to see him feel more comfortable in the side, and you can tell he's more comfortable in the side just with the way he's attacking the ball, and the way he's moving the ball as well, taking the game on a lot more. He obviously feels a lot more comfortable as an AFL player than he was at the end of last year when he came back from his injury. But just sort of touching again on players who was really pleasing to see their efforts on the weekend. And again, this is something that's happened across the season in the first three games. It hasn't been the same people contributing to the wins. There's been different players bob up and have big impacts. So the two that obviously really stood out this week were Harry Jones and Xavier Dersma. Obviously, Jones was a late in when Setterfield went out, but seeing him getting up the ground, taking marks, and then hitting the scoreboard really makes a huge difference the way we move the ball. Whilst Dersma, he's been pretty good defensively the first 2 weeks, but we haven't seen much of the flair that he showed, particularly early on in Port Adelaide. We saw just how important he can be as an attacking player, whilst also having those fantastic defensive efforts, the tackle on Marshall, the spoil in the goal square. That's really what you want to see from a great wingman, someone who can contribute defensively, offensively, and in helping with the transition of the ball from one end to the other.
Yeah, I was really happy for Harry Jones. I've been a supporter of his from day one, and he's had that game in him. He really stood up when we needed him within the game, didn't he? His two goals in the first half each came after St Kilda had kicked two goals in a row and threatened to blow the game out a little bit. So the timing of him, taking those marks and going back and converting his set shots were really, really important for us, because it stopped the St Kilda momentum. And then his, just his competitiveness and his work up and down the ground, really, really did shine. So yeah, he set a new standard for himself, and looking forward to seeing him continue to build on that. And yeah, you're spot on regarding Dersma, mate. He might take a bit longer than our other new recruits to really hit his straps, given that he had a bit of a delayed start to the preseason. But there was a lot to like about him on Saturday. And yeah, I think we had five different players get votes in the coaches' votes, which is a bit of an indication that we are getting a decent spread of players contributing to the win. And I don't think that included Jake Stringer, who didn't get a vote either, who obviously, played a really important role, as did, Kyle Langford and a number of others. So yeah, it was good to get a really good spread, and as you said, different players popping up when we needed them. Well, that sort of does the review for this week, mate. What caught your eyes in the media during the week?
Well, look, it is sort of related to St Kilda game, and there's been a lot of questions about how impactful Nick Martin's game was. So he had the 44 disposals, and that ties in with two Darcy Parish efforts in 2021 and 22 for the most disposals by an Essendon player. But some have argued against it being a good game, citing that some of those disposals have come from kickouts. Some have questioned his ball use, given he had seven turnovers, whilst others have spoken about his lack of impact on scoring. So only five of those possessions ended in scores. So I think that there's been a real effort to talk his game down in the media. And I think when it first was happening at the time, I was probably not as big on the game that he played as I am now, sort of reflecting on it. So I'm going to use a comparison here. So Martin's playing that sort of Nick Dacos role, the role that's made Nick Dacos a star and been a big reason why Collingwood have been successful. So what I did was I compared Martin's game with Nick Dacos's leading possession game, which was when he got 42 disposals, ironically against St Kilda. So that was when they played in Adelaide last year for Gather Round. The scores were fairly similar. There was only a goal in it between the Pies and the Saints, and the scores were around 70 to 65. So again, a really similar game to what we played on the weekend. So I thought it was a really good comparison point. So in Dacos's game, he had four score involvements, zero clearances, six turnovers, six intercept possessions, six contested possessions, eight inside 50s, a disposal efficiency of 76%, and 856 meters gained. So if you look at Martin's game on the weekend, where he had 44 disposals, that included five score involvements. He had three clearances, seven turnovers, seven intercept possessions, eight contested possessions, three inside 50s, 75% disposal efficiency, and 781 meters gained. Now, Dacos's game, when it was reflected on by both the coaches and the umpires, got 10 coaches' votes. So five from both coaches as the best player on the ground. And the umpires thought the same. So they gave him three Brownlow votes. So what I did was I put those numbers out on both Twitter and our Patreon, and I took away the names and the possession numbers just to have them as two separate games that people could compare without considering who the players were, although there were a couple of people who did figure it out, and asked people to indicate which game they thought was better. And I had Dacos's game as game number one and Martin's game as game number two. Just from looking at those numbers, 60% of people on Twitter and 52% of people on our Patreon chose Martin's game over Dacos. And again, look, that obviously doesn't tell the whole story. For example, if you go look at the heat maps, Martin's game was mostly played out of the sort of the back line, whereas Dacos's game was played more on the wing, but that sort of reflected the different levels of dominance and possession in the two games there. Whereas we were, especially at the start when Martin was getting a lot of his early disposals, we were having to move the ball right from the back line, whereas the St Kilda Collingwood game was a bit more of an arm wrestle from the start. And I didn't do this exercise to say that Martin's game was somehow better than Dacos, but my main focus is that a lot of people, particularly in the media, as I said, have spent a lot of time trying to talk down what he did on the weekend. And I'm looking at you, Daniel Hoyne. What he's had is he had a really, really good game. And if we get more like that from him in the future, we're going to be in a really good spot. So I think there's been way too much time spent talking down what he did and not enough time talking up exactly just how good a game he had. You were there. You got to see it live. How did you see his game, and how are you finding him in his new role at halfback? Do you think it's working for the side?
I think the short answer to your follow-up question there was yes, I do think it is. Look, it was a mixed bag, wasn't it? He made some costly errors early, in the first quarter and a bit. He was one of those that was fumbling, and he dropped a couple of marks and gave the ball back a couple of times and missed some targets. But at other times, he was really influential in helping us to transition, to intercept, and to score ourselves. And the thing that I absolutely love about Nick Martin is that regardless of what has happened in his previous involvement, he throws everything into his next involvement. He seems to move on really quickly from a mistake, which is exactly what you want from a player who's playing in a pretty high pressure role and an important one. Look, we're fundamentally trying to change the way that we move the ball from a slow build up kick mark team to a more aggressive, fast moving team. And we're trying to do that on the back of Nick Martin, a player who I think we all forget or often forget because he hit the ground running so well in his debut year, is only three games into his third season in the AFL. So, yeah, to give the responsibility of your whole offensive game plan and ball transition to a player that's that young, I think says a lot about the where the club sees him and the faith that they have in him. Look, I think he's clearly adjusting. He's a player who, to me, looks like he's formerly played on instinct and typically has really good instincts. He doesn't tend to need to think. He's good at buying himself a half a second that he needs to be able to move the ball. But this new role, it means that the whole ground is open to him. He has more options, more decisions to process. And I think that he's just adjusting to seeing more of the ground ahead of him and not quite backing himself in just at the moment. I think that will improve pretty quickly with a little bit of time. On the rating system, and what did you say? He was ranked 16th best player on the ground. The champion data rating system or ranking system is a little bit like the KFC Seven Herbs and Spices. No one really knows what's in it or how it all works. But what I do know and do understand from having seen the data come in, to the box on game day live, is that it really does it value involvements late in a game, particularly when it's a close game. So let's use the example of Harry Jones's goal in the first quarter versus Jake Stringer's last goal of the match. Both were worth 6 points on the scoreboard. Harry's goal in quarter one stopped a two-goal run and allowed us to settle and get our first goal of the game. And Jake Stringer's goal is, ultimately the one that put us in front and enabled us to win the game. But both are worth 6 points. Jake Stringer is not in the position to kick the match winner if Harry Jones doesn't convert his shot in the first quarter. But on the ranking system, Stringer would have received a lot more ranking points just due to the match situation happening late in the game, games close, etc. Nick only had 5 of his 44 disposals in the last quarter, and the ball spent so much time in the forward half of the ground that he didn't really have opportunities to be involved like he was in the first three quarters. So he would have artificially been penalised in the ranking system because he just wasn't involved late in the game when quote-unquote, the game was there to be won. But everything that he had done up to that point helped to put us in a position for, the likes of Jake Stringer to have that influence right at the end. So, yeah, I still think he had a very, very good game, mate. And like I said, I think, we forget sometimes that he's only in his third AFL season. He's got a lot of development ahead of him and we've got ourselves a beauty.
Yeah. And I think there's been, questions about taking him away from the wing and are we hurting ourselves there? But I think Dersmer's game on the weekend probably negates that somewhat. We've got options there on the wing, and that's one of the reasons why we targeted a player like Dersmer to bring him in. So we had that wing depth so we can make more choices with what we did with both Martin playing him at half back and then Sam Durham moving him into the midfield. I think my one concern about it so far is not necessarily to do with Nick's game, but it does seem to have taken away from Redmond's playmaking a bit. It's only been 2 games that Redmond's played. He obviously missed round 2, but it doesn't feel like Mason's been involved in the games as much as he has been in the past. And that may change as they start to work out how best to structure things. But it also does mean now that the teams have multiple threats from Essendon that they have to contain from the half-back line, especially also considering Andy McGrath's start to the year. So it does create a lot of headaches for teams, whereas last year they could have just sat on Mason Redmond and cut off a lot of our ball movement from half-back. So a bit of a watch on how Mason adjusts to the new paradigm of how the team moves the ball from half-back. But overall, I think it gives us a whole lot more options and it makes us a lot more of a dangerous side moving the ball.
Yeah, I think the wing roles changed. But a couple of years ago, they were link players and you were seeing wingers get lots of the ball and being involved heavily, whereas now, the wing roles almost being bypassed in ball movement because of the focus on halfback and having attacking halfbacks and really aggressive ball movement from that part of the ground. So the wingers are a bit more structural. They're there to help out defensively. They're there to create space and push forward when they can, but it's not typically as high a disposal impact as we've maybe seen in the past. On Mason, he's had a quieter 2 games than we're used to, but look, I don't think it's anything to be concerned about, mate. I think it's a really good problem to have. Should we move on to Port?
Yeah, let's touch on the Power. So Port Adelaide finished season 2023 in third position after the regular season, and that's their third time in the previous 4 years that they'd finished inside the top four. However, they went out of the finals in straight sets, losing to Brisbane away and GWS at home. So a disappointing end to what they would have thought would have been a chance at a premiership. So far in 2024, they've won two games and lost one. They're sitting at eighth with a percentage of 128. Had a bit of a soft start to the year. They came up against West Coast and then Richmond, although they did play Richmond at the MCG, and we have just seen Richmond knock off probably the best team in the competition so far in the Swans. So maybe I'm underselling that win that Port had against Richmond, but then they did lose to the Cats on the weekend, which we'll touch on in a bit. So just looking at some of their statistical markers, last season the Power kicked the ball 1.6 times for every handball, and that was third in the comp. This season, they've actually jumped up to 1.79 per handball, which is the top of the league. It was actually 1.9 before the Geelong game. So one of the reasons why Geelong was able to win that game was the fact that they were able to make Port Adelaide handball the ball rather than kick it, although they still kicked it at quite a high percentage. So that's what that's done, that kicking the ball so much more than every handball, is it's contributed to their territory dominance. So they've averaged 16 more inside 50s than their opponents across the start of the competition. And they're also the most efficient team in the league. So they score 58% of the time that they enter, although they are giving up a score 52% of the time their opposition enters their forward 50. That last number there is equal to the Bombers so far in 2024 in terms of opposition efficiency inside 50.
Yeah, they're the number one ranked team in the AFL for kicks and 16th for handball. So that's driving that, kick to handball ratio the way that it is. They're number one for inside 50s and they're conceding the fewest inside 50s in the competition. So, yeah, their ability or want to transition the ball by foot is, particularly coming out of stoppages as well, is really driving the end product for them.
Yeah, and part of that ranking so far is who they've played. But we'll see how that evens out over the course of a year. But, it does suggest that they're fairly effective in those areas. And another area where they're really effective is in clearance. And this game is going to be the clash of the two best clearance sides in the league to this point. So in comparison, Essendon is first in centre clearances with +5 per game this year in terms of centre clearance differential, whilst the Power are second with +2.3. Whilst at stoppage, the Power are first with +4.33, with the Bombers third at +2.67. So really big game in the contest in right in close there, and we'll touch on that in our match preview. But what Port have then been doing once they win the clearances, they've really been controlling the ball on the outside. So they're running 40 more uncontested possessions than their opponent and taking 29 more marks, and that includes 11 more inside 50. So that's they're the league leaders in the last two metrics there in terms of marks and marks inside 50 differential. So they're winning the ball in the clinches and then they're really controlling it on the outside. So it really strikes me that this game is win the contest, win the game type matchup for us. But I think Port, based on what we've seen, have a few more tricks up their sleeve that we have to be worried about rather than us at the moment, which is really focused on that clearance game.
Yeah, I think winning clearance is going to allow either team to get the game on their own terms. And if you've got momentum, it's going to be the difference between keeping it or giving it back to the opposition. So, there's going to be a lot of focus on that this week. Port a fifth for marks and concede the most marks to their opposition. They're 16th for intercepts and 15th for tackles. So that clearance piece is so important to how they want to play because they're not great necessarily at winning the ball back from their opposition, albeit they do it more than their opposition does from them, but they're doing it in a game style or game environment where they're not conceding much ball to the opposition in the first place. Having been bundled out in straight sets last year, as you mentioned, mate, they made some pretty big changes in the offseason. Do you want to talk us through that quickly?
Yeah, so they let go of 10 players at the end of the 2023 season in a bid to refresh their list for a flagship. They obviously think they're in their window there. Hinkley's been there for over a decade now, so I think he's really keen for success, as everyone is, obviously. The biggest out for them is obviously Xavier Dersma, who's ended up at Essendon. He played 16 games for them in 2023. They had two retirements in Scott Lysette and former captain Tom Jonas. They played 14 and 13 games, respectively. And then there were seven other players who were delisted. So Riley Bonner, who we came up against for the Saints last week. He played 11 games for them in 2023. Orazio Fantasia was picked up as a delisted free agent by Carlton. And then Sam Hayes, who's the brother of Essendon's Lewis, and Bryn Teagle both played 4 games last year, ended up being delisted. And then there were 3 others, including former North player Trent Dumont, who didn't feature in 2023, who were also delisted. So Port really focused on shoring up their tall timber in both the ruck and defensive positions. Obviously, they had Lysette retire, who was doing a lot of their ruck work in combination with Finlayson. And they needed to find some support for Alia Lear. So they've brought in Xavier Radiglia from Geelong and Brandon Zerk-Thatcher from Essendon. Zerk-Thatcher as part of that Dersma trade as key defenders. And then Ivan Soldo from Richmond and Jordan Sweet from the Bulldogs have come in as ruckmen. So all three of those four, so all but Sweet, featured in the 3 power games to date. In order to get those trades across the line, they had to trade out most of their draft capital, meaning their first pick in the draft didn't come until pick 48. And none of their 3 draft picks or their rookie selection are yet to featured in 2024.
Yeah, BCT and Radiglia have made really solid starts to their Port career. Neither of them have lost a one-on-one yet this year, although they're not getting involved in a lot of them. The benefit of Port getting those two to the club is Alia can do what he does best, and that's intercept and intercept marked and basically play as the third tool. So that's something that we're going to have to really keep an eye on. But they played West Coast and Richmond. People have different views on where Richmond are at, but I think they're not the team, clearly not the team they once were. So they're still, despite playing some softer opposition, they're 11th for points against. So that they're not, they haven't set the house on fire from a defensive perspective in terms of stopping scores. That said, we're not faring any better in that regard. We're ranked 13th.
Yeah. Well, look, reflecting on the last game we had against Port back in round 16, 2023, it was the second time that we played them that year, and it was another close loss with Essendon 10-14, 74, losing to Port 11-12, 78. And I'm sure we're all still carrying the scars of that Dan Houston kick after the siren from outside 50 to get the Port over the line. It was a game where Port dominated the first quarter, but they only scored 2 goals from their first 9 scores in that quarter. So they finished that quarter with 2 goals 7. We had 2 goals 2. So a bit like St Kilda this week, they kept us in the game with poor kicking. And the match really seesawed for the rest of the next couple of quarters until Port pulled out 17 points ahead midway through the final quarter, only for the Bombers to kick 3 quick ones to retake the lead before Houston seals the game after the siren. They were really closely matched all night. Neither side had a really significant advantage in any of the key metrics. Port did end up with 5 more inside 50s, but the Bombers defenders actually restricted them to an efficiency of only 41.82, which was Port's second lowest for the season. So whilst Port got the ball inside their 50 quite a lot, our defenders did a fantastic job in denying them scoring opportunities from that. In terms of individual players, Zach Merritt led the disposals for Essendon with 32, as well as 600 metres gained, whilst Darcy Parrish had 29. Parrish was also, he got forward and had shots, but he kicked 4 behinds, and arguably that was one of the reasons why we weren't able to pull out the win. Jai Caldwell had 24 disposals and 2 goals, and his 2 goals were contributed to getting us back in front right by the end in that final quarter, whilst Kyle Langford kicked 3. Dan Houston, as well as kicking the match winner, was the dominant player for the power with 32 disposals, whilst Connor Rosie had a really good game as a midfielder, goal-kicking midfielder with 3 goals.
Yeah, we had 2 really close games against Port last year, didn't we? We lost to them by 5 points at the Adelaide Oval in round 8 and then 4 points at the G in round 16. Look, I think they're just a team that we match up well against. They have a lot of weapons across the ground, and we'll touch on that a little bit later, but they also don't typically have those big, dominant, heavy, tall, explosive mids that tend to walk all over us either. So yeah, I think we're evenly matched up, and for that reason, we should go into this week reasonably confident of, putting up a good show.
Yeah, well, we are due for a win against Port Adelaide. We've lost the last 7 games against them, some of them close, some of them not so close, unfortunately. So hopefully eighth time lucky for us this weekend. And given we are recording on Wednesday this week, because I am flying out tomorrow and you're also flying off on business tomorrow. So Thursday was out as a recording date. We don't actually have the official teams yet, so we are flying a bit blind when it does come to selection. So anything we do say here will need to be taken with a grain of salt, given what will come out tomorrow. But we know from an Essendon perspective that Ridley and Guelphy aren't available yet, although it does seem likely that Setterfield will come back in after missing the St Kilda game with knee soreness. We do know that Durham is already confirmed out with the concussion protocols. Is this week as simple as Durham out, Setterfield in, or are there other changes to be looking at making? Jai Menzies probably has the most precarious spot right now. He's probably the one player that's been in the side all 3 weeks that hasn't really had a strong performance yet. But there's also not necessarily someone ready to replace him from the VFL in that role either, especially with Guelphy still out there.
Yeah, look, we know Brad Scott likes to keep things pretty simple, so I think it's likely that we just make the one change. The VFL played on Sunday as well, so it's a 5-day break for anyone there that might be backing up to have played on Sunday and then back up and play on Friday. I stand to be corrected, but I don't think we saw anyone on managed minutes in the VFL who they hooked at halftime or three quarter time to freshen up. So I think that's likely a bit of a clue. They would have I expected had a match committee meeting either on Saturday night or Sunday to give the VFL team a bit of a heads up of what some of the thinking was around selection ahead of this week. So yeah, on that basis, I do think it's likely to be a pretty simple night at selection.
Yeah, and just on the VFL, the scheduling of that competition is a joke. It's really frustrating that we've only played two VFL games and there's already a bye for the Victoria South Australia game. It means Dylan Scheel, who could be a really important part of our AFL side going forward, will have to wait another week to get back into it after seemingly recover from the injury he got before our first VFL game. So it is frustrating that it's hard for players to build that continuity in the VFL. And there's a lot of talk that there will be a seconds competition for the AFL. And if that comes in, hopefully they can get some better scheduling to make sure that the players are ready to go for the AFL side, not having all these interruptions there. But just turning attention to the Power, they are going to be missing Ollie Wines who has a hamstring issue. And it does sound like that Jason Horne-Francis will be back from them, though. So it looks like for them, again, a pretty straight stop there with Ollie Wines going out and Jason Horne-Francis coming in. So, in essence, they're not losing a whole lot there, although Wines has been their leading clearance player all year. So he may affect that their clearance dominance they've had to this point.
Yeah, he's not just their leading clearance player, but he's actually ranked third in the AFL for clearances per game. He's third at Port for disposals, first for contested possessions. He's not the player that he was when he won the Brownlow, but he's still having a really strong year and moved back into a role that's a bit more what we expect to see of him. So yeah, he will be missed, but yeah, Jason Horne-Francis is obviously a really super young player.
Yeah, and they bet pretty deep in that area, obviously. Rosie and Butters quite impactful in that. Willem Drew's having a really good year, and sort of that he's probably their second best clearance midfielder after Wines at the moment. And then Horne-Francis is obviously a super talent. So if he comes back in and he's in any sort of form, we're not going to have an easy time of it in that midfield battle. Let's just look at what happened for Port Adelaide in the last game they played, which they lost to Melbourne 13-11-89 to Melbourne's 15-6-96. The Power twice got out to roughly 15-point leads, but they never really could shake Melbourne, whose superior accuracy in front of goal allowed them to eke out that 7-point win. It was a match, if you can think back, Essendon supporters, to how we lost to Sydney last year. It was one of those ones where Port dominated territory. They had 21 more inside 50s. They were heading clearances by 15. They won at centre bounce and around the ground stoppage. They took seven more marks and had 11 more tackles inside 50. They just couldn't make the most of it on the scoreboard. They did have really even input from their main centre bounce midfielders. So Butters and Rosie both had 26 possessions and Wines and Drew had 25 each. And the latter two had 8 and 10 clearances respectively. They had a wide variety of goal kickers. 10 Port players kicked goals, with Rioli, Finlayson and Burn Jones kicking two each.
Yeah, this was a really good game to watch, mate. It was pretty much straight on after our game. So, yeah, got home from the footy and sat on the couch and and got a chance to watch this from an Essendon perspective. Given their game was, as I said, played immediately after ours, and both teams were going to get a 6 day break into our battle. It was nice to see Port have a real arm wrestle against a pretty physical opposition from start to finish. We had a tough game, so it was nice to see them have one too. The raw numbers do suggest Port should have won easily, but despite being +5 from centre clearances, they didn't really put it on the scoreboard. It was 13-9 in Port's favour, so only a 4 point advantage there. And then Port were +10 from stoppages, but were outscored 33-19 by Melbourne from that source. So, yeah, it's unlike what we've typically seen from Melbourne of late, where they've been able to get the ball inside 50 and not score. They were really clean and effective going forward, more so than Port. And Max Gawn was hugely influential in that. He had 50 hitouts on his own. Port had 30 for the match. So he just dominated in that part of the ground. And it meant when Melbourne did win clearance, they were a lot more effective, with their movement out of it than Port Adelaide were.
Yeah. So turning to the matchup itself, and we've got a clash, as we sort of hinted at earlier. They're probably the two best clearance sides going around in the competition at the moment. We've touched on the game that both sides will be missing key figures in the clinches, with Durham out for us and Wines for them. But I think you touched on Max Gawn having such a big impact for Melbourne. Just on paper, I would argue that we probably have the superior ruck combo in Draper and Goldstein compared to Soldo and Finlayson. How important will those two for us being in setting the tone for the game?
Yeah, pretty significant. Maybe we touched on, or I just touched on Max Gawn last week and the influence that he had. I think it's a huge opportunity for Draper and Goldstein to give us a massive advantage in this game. Soldo's been in the system for a while now. I think he debuted back in 2017 from memory, but he hasn't played a lot of footy as the number one ruckman. He's sort of been a bit of forward, even a bit of key defence at times, and then being asked to do some ruck duty. So this is his first real crack at an AFL season as the number one ruckman. And, he's not someone who I think has a lot of genuine ruck craft. He ranks below average this season for hit out win to percentage. So, or hit out win percentage. So yeah, he's not getting his hands on the ball, as much as his opponents are. And, I think if we were only to play the one ruckman, this would be an opportunity for us to get a significant advantage. With two, we should be really looking to work them over. I think if Finlayson does go into the ruck, and he may or may not, but that would concern us a little bit if we got the Goldstein matchup, because he could really run over the top of Goldie. But Goldie will still chase and pressure him reasonably well. But yeah, otherwise I think we should be able to really get some ascendancy in that contest.
Yeah. And I guess we've touched on the clearance game and how evenly matched it is, but I think based on just the raw stats, the key difference between the two sides is the intercept game. So Port have a positive intercept differential, although as you sort of hinted at, it's not based on a large amount of intercepts. They're just winning more than their opponents, whereas we have a negative one. So even if we win the clearances, we may have difficulty getting scores due to or superior intercept game. You've touched on Allaire. We know from our experience that Zerk Thatcher is probably a better intercept defender than he is a one-on-one defender. I guess even if we win the clearances, we may have difficulty getting those scores due to Port setup there. And I guess, and then turning in terms of thinking the other way, we managed to lock the ball in against the Saints. And how do we recreate that this week and not let Port get on top, even if we are winning clearance and gaining territory from that?
Yeah, Port are +3 for intercepts per game this season, which ranks them 6th in the AFL. But they're similar to us in a way, similar to us in 2023 in a way, in that they don't play in games or that generate a lot of intercepts. They average 59 intercepts a game, which ranks them only ahead of West Coast and North Melbourne this year on raw numbers. We average 64, so only, marginally better. But we had 77 intercepts against St Kilda on the weekend, which would rank us number one in the AFL if it was our season average. Obviously, we've only seen one example of it so far. They're third in the AFL for winning turnovers in their between the centre and their forward 50, so the forward half of their midfield. But they're below average in the defensive half of their midfield and the defensive 50. They're right on the AFL average for generating turnovers in forward 50. So I think it speaks to their ability to get clearance, get territory, and then be able to defend it, because their turnovers are largely concentrated in that part of the ground, much like we did against the Saints, really. But this is where I think the move of Nick Martin to halfback is important, because we're going to need him and Redmond and McGrath, you know, running and overlapping to break through that Port Adelaide press. So where we spoke last week about the St Kilda game and wanting, St Kilda sitting back a little bit and wanting to really see some controlled disposal outside of defensive 50, Port Adelaide's a game where we are going to need to, they're going to bring the game to us. So we are going to need to run and gun a little bit more and take some risks, which, you know, we've got three players there that are capable of doing it. And I think we really need to see Harry Jones and our rucks get up the ground and provide us with leading options. We want to avoid just kicking down the line as much as possible. So we do want to create those one-on-ones, you know, down the line and get a really good contest there so that we can, really take them on in that part of the ground and look to get over the back of the Port Adelaide press.
Yeah, big game for those both ends of the ground in terms of moving through that press, the back half trying to penetrate it, and the forward half getting up and providing those options there. Speaking of threats, who are the major Port Adelaide threats that we need to keep an eye on? Is there anyone you'd be looking to lock down on, particularly in that midfield brigade, or someone off the half back line is more of a concern?
Yeah, they've got some really offensive midfield options, don't they? With it, and you touched on it, you know, Horn Francis is really explosive out of the clearance, as are Rosie and Butters, and all three of them really can hit the scoreboard and hurt you that way. William Drew gives them a defensive edge to their midfield, and I think it's probably likely we'll see him go to Zach Merritt. The one thing to watch there is he is their sort of next go-to for contested ball and clearance, and without Wines, they might have to use Drew as just a bit more of see-ball, get-ball type of player. A bit of a watch on how that ends up flowing through. And then they've got, you know, Burton, Houston and Farrell down back who are all really good users and can hurt you by foot. And then they've got plenty of goal threat options in their forward 50 as well. So they're really well balanced and got some real threats all throughout the ground. I don't think this is about locking down on anyone in particular. Setterfield will do what Setterfield does and go to their most attacking midfielder at any point in or at any stoppage when he's out on the ground. I think we get them for size, which is a bit rare for us to be bigger than the opposition midfield. But, you know, Setterfield and Perkins in there, I think that we have an opportunity just to focus a little bit more on what we do rather than too much about what they do, and then just get that balance between offense and defense right at stoppages, focus on the contest and then really look to spread their defense.
Yep. And again, thinking about who Port Adelaide may want to lock down on, who are we wanting to make sure we can get free and get involved in the game to give us the best chance of winning?
Yeah, I think the Nick Martin role is really important this week, mate. I've already touched on that a little bit, but if he can give us plenty of drive from halfback back to help get through that press, then we should be able to get the territory that we need for the rest of our games, the rest of our game to flourish. With Wines out, I think it's unlikely that they'll shift Drew out of the midfield to lock down on Nick, but if he is getting well held, and you know they have the potential to send someone like a Burn Jones to him to lock down on him a little bit, then yeah, we really need Mason Redmond to step up and take the initiative in helping us break through. The difference with, I think, Redmond compared to Andy McGrath is that he does have a really penetrating foot. We know he can kick, you know, 50 metres plus on the run. So that gives him the potential to be a 60 or 70 metre player, you know, run 10 or 20 metres and then kick the ball 40 or 50 and really help to get the ball up the ground. Our forwards have done a pretty good job of separating this season, and that will be really important again, given, you know, that if we allow Alir just, and we're predictable going forward, and we allow Alir to just intercept and have a field day, then it's going to be really hard for us to put a score on the board. So that halfback role important to ball movement and getting through and over their zone, and then our forwards separating to make sure that we've got plenty of options. We can lower our eyes and hit up targets as we're going inside 50.
Yep. And look, it's our first time facing Willy Rioli since he had that hit that concussed Jordan Ridley back in round 8 last year. He did miss the round 16 game. I know that there's probably some people who want us to get stuck into him, given what he did and his action there. But the match review panel's been pretty trigger happy with suspensions, and we've already lost a couple of players to suspension. So all I can say is,
Do not touch Willie. Good advice.
and look, let's turn to our final thoughts, and going to make this a personal one this week. Given I'm going to be at Adelaide Oval for the game, my likelihood of getting out in one piece if the Bombers win on the night would be what, Jono?
I think it's pretty low of getting out in one piece, regardless of the result, mate. I've had the misfortune of being at Port Adelaide sitting games in finals that we've lost, and albeit at Footy Park rather than Adelaide Oval, and yeah, got some pretty feral treatment leaving the ground. I wouldn't certainly wouldn't wish that on you, mate. So yeah, look, if you haven't had a tetanus shot recently, I'd really recommend you go and get one before you fly out tomorrow. But I do think the benefit of playing Port in Gather Round is that we split the ticket allocation. So I reckon there's going to be a big Bomber contingent there, mate. I'm sure you'll fly the flag loud and proud. And yeah, I think there's a big chance that it's going to sound more like an Essendon home game than a Port Adelaide one.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed. And look, in the event that I fail to get away safely, and can no longer do the show because I'm now deceased by the hands of a Port fan, and someone listening would like to become the new co-host of Don the Stat, please email us at donthestat@gmail.com. In your email, please include your name, age, and three words you would use to describe the Carlton Football Club.
Well, let's hope it doesn't come to that, mate. But I can think of one word. I don't think people need three words to describe Carlton. I'd hope they could sum it up in one.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, look, that'll do us for tonight. Thanks again to everyone who's listened and interacted with us this week. We always appreciate it. If you are someone who is an Essendon fan and is going to be at Gather Round this weekend and would like to meet up for a drink or a chat, hit me up on Twitter. You can find my profile in the description of this episode, or send an email to the beforementioned donthestat@gmail.com. Any final words from you, Jono?
Yeah, no, just if you do want to check out the first episode of the Medical Room with Pat, remember you can sign up to our Patreon on a free 7-day trial and try before you buy. So yeah, good opportunity to jump in and give that a listen, as well as all of the other content that's on there. Enjoy your time in Adelaide, mate. Have safe travels. I hope you do get out alive for obvious reasons, and let's hope we can keep our undefeated Gather Round winning streak alive.
Yep, fingers crossed. And just on our first thoughts episode for this coming week, because I'll be in Adelaide, I won't be able to do it. Jono, you flew solo last week while I was at the Comedy Festival, and I think you've organised for your brother to be back on the first thoughts again. So looking forward to hearing that. Looks, as always, stay safe, everyone, and go Dons.